Okay, everybody, it's time to get started. It is 8:15, which means we are up to our third part of our four-part series on the Yom Kippur War at 50. The title of this year is Yom Kippur, or the series has been the Yom Kippur War at 50. This is the 50th year since the Yom Kippur War. And we're looking at Torah leaders, leadership, and lessons. So in the first before I get to the first couple, I need to point out that this year, this evening, is actually going to be given as part of a larger program. That has been coordinated by Dr. Marati, but has been sponsored by the Felts, the Fish family, the Maratis, the Rosenbaums, and the Sinkfors, as well as others who asked to remain anonymous. And there is a large list of cholim. Yaakov Chaim Halevi ben Chonam, Tzvi ben Gittel, Chaya Esther Malka Basarel, Yoel ben Perel, Dan ben Carmela, Eta Bas Golda, Tzvi ben Tova, Yachit Basarelea, Fruma Bracha Baslea, Tzion ben Mazel, Shoshana Tova Baslea, Alana Chana Bas Gila Brinla, Gittel Bas Mindel, Blima Bas Malka, Ariele ben Asnat, Tinok ben Sarah, Skyla Yasmin ben Flori Victoria Yael, Perel Bas Frumit, and Bela Bas Chava, as well as Sarah Chana Bas Miriam Disha, and Rachel Bas Ita. Everyone should just have a refuah shlema bekarov mamash, and only good things in the upcoming year. In the course of our series so far, we have selected three. So far, we've covered two. Tonight, we're going to look at the third of the different Torah leaders. Tomorrow, Mirz Hashem, next week, same bat time, same bat channel on the Zoom, we'll look at a fourth leader with a fourth perspective. And what we really did was we went back through the Yom Kippur War. Over Yantif had a pleasure of reading through one of the secular reviews of the Yom Kippur War at 50. Immediately after, Israel has had quite a number of experiences in its short life. And in the context, there were certain wars that brought out certain experiences and other wars that created a little bit more of a change and a challenge. So, for instance, the war in 48 was the War of Independence. People thought that, this tiny little country would last a day or two. And, Am Yisrael was the nation that, Medinat Yisrael was the nation that could, and it shocked the world. There was a Sinai campaign in 56, right? And then what really blew the world beyond was the Six-Day War in 1967. Wars were not supposed to be fought in 6 days, but, Shabbos was coming. So, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to go ahead and make changes. Shavuos was up and coming. And, there was a certain understanding in the world at large, and certainly even within Israeli society, that we were unbeatable. And that, unfortunately, at different points in time, there were also beliefs that, when we think about it and we talk about it, there were certain underbeliefs that people had, that we didn't need to worry about anything because we had Tzahal. We had, in particular, the Air Force. My father-in-law, he should be continued to be well, was a member of the Air Force in 67 and 73. Less than 73 by then, he was already retired. But in 67, he fought in the war, right? And he said, the belief in the Air Force, there was the Air Force and then there was the rest of the Army. When it came to 73, the Air Force, which was believed to be, the great crown prince, was hampered majorly. The fighting among Israel had relied on intelligence in 67, 56, etc. Intelligence failed miserably in 73. In fact, if you go back and read the historical encounter from the secular side, you would call it non-intelligence. At every step of the game, one of the things that almost automatically guarantees that an army is not going to be successful is when its leadership doesn't work together, right? And of course, if you read the accounts from the secular side, you'll see that the secular generals, the Israelis, they were Israelis, they're Jewish, etc., but you'll see that they didn't work together. So from the perspective of the secular review of the Yom Kippur War, there was a lot that had to be learned. But we're not here to talk about the secular society and the way that the Aragot Commission, which was formed after the 73 war to examine from all different levels what exactly went wrong in the war. that doesn't really do me a lot of good. It doesn't really impress me, and it doesn't serve something I think was worthy of really looking back at 50 years. It's interesting what you really see behind the scenes when you read past things like the Argo Commission report is that there's something that's very, very strongly missing. And I think it's something that we've been trying to fill in our analysis from all the different points of Torah leadership, and that's God, right? There's no question that our biggest and most important weapon, and by the way, our only weapon, and whenever we have to deal with threats from the outside, is the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu fights for us, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there and he sets us up. And when you read the secular understanding and you fill in the gaps, how certain things should not have happened in a certain way, how bridges were not able to get down to the Suez Canal, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, that, you know, an Egyptian whole army turned itself into the wrong direction and faced the wrong way. Well, how do you think that happened, right? How do you think those things started to happen? That there was a turnaround from the Syrian side, that the Jordanians chose not to join the war, also until it was too late, that the Iraqis who were coming through at the request of the Syrians got turned away in a split second, and they were incompetent, right? All these things happen, quite honestly, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns the picture. And that's an important element to understand. But at the same time, there are elements that we need to understand for ourselves, and how we function and how our Torah leadership function. And so the first thing we did on the first week was we talked about Reb Chaim Shmulevitz. Why? Because Reb Chaim Shmulevitz was the Rosh Yeshiva, the biggest yeshiva in the world at the time. Which yeshiva, you know? The Mir Yeshiva. The Mir Yeshiva in Yerushalayim is the world's biggest yeshiva. Hands down. Right? There are thousands upon thousands of people learning in Mir. In 1973, it was still the largest yeshiva in the world, probably not with thousands upon thousands, but thousands, right, of Talmidim. And Reb Chaim Shmulevitz was the Rosh Yeshiva. He had gone through the war, and he was not a young man. He died in 78, right? He had gone through the war. He had gone through World War II. He traveled with the yeshiva to Shanghai, right? He had gone to the United States for a very short while, and then he relocated the yeshiva with Rav Lazy Yehuda Finkel to Yerushalayim Mir HaKodesh, and that was where the yeshiva has thrived. By the way, that's why there is a Mir in Brooklyn. The reason why there's a Mir yeshiva, you know, when you go visit, you drive up, you know where Mir yeshiva is? So the reason that there's a Mir yeshiva in Brooklyn is because the yeshiva first came to the United States, and the Europeans said, we can't live here, this is not a place for us. And they wound up in Yerushalayim, and they really set a presence. And that presence continues to be incredibly strong until today. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz was not only famous for the fact that he was a huge Talmud Chacham, could teach anything, but after the Mashgiach of the yeshiva passed away, he took on the responsibility of not only being Rosh Yeshiva, but being Mashgiach as well. And that's why from 1970 to 1973, the Shmuzin, his ethical discourses, were written up, and they were called Sichos Moser. By the way, they're gold even today. They might as well have been written yesterday, right? And he would give this to thousands of people because not only would yeshiva boys come to hear Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, but people would come in from the outside to come hear him. And by the way, you can still listen to him if you really want to. If you go to Kol HaLashon and you want to go back and hear the old recordings of Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, I spoke about this. I wrote this in an OU article I wrote about 5 or 6 years ago on the positives of technology, right? I have to compare everything, right? There are positives. You can listen to people from generations ago. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz is one of the people you can listen to. And this is the way it was for many, many years. You had those shmuzin and they ended, and that's fine. Then a second volume appeared with earlier Shmuzin of Reb Chaim Shmulevitz. I have both of those volumes at home. But then it was pointed out to me that about 5 or 6 years ago, a new volume of Sichas Moser came out, right? And in this volume, which had all the Shmuzin from 70 to 73, right? Except that at the back, their last 6 Shmuzin are all from the period of time from the Yom Kippur War. So they're fantastic. They're brilliant. We talked about them. And Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, for us, brought out certain ideas about how a person has to focus on tefillah, and how a person has to focus on thinking about his fellow man, and how a person focuses on learning. When you're not the guy at the front, how are you supposed to be the man or the woman at the front? right? Because Am Yisrael has to work together. And this was, we identified five or six themes that came out of his writing and out of his being that I think reflect for us even until today and really gave us guidance. And I recommend that you go back onto YU Torah, onto our subsection, you'll be able to find that first perspective. Last week we talked about Rabbi Yehuda Amital. Rabbi Yehuda Amital is perhaps, in my opinion, Rabbi Yehuda Amital is a representative of a different Torah community. Whereas Rav Chaim Shmulevitz was speaking, and his themes were very much geared towards an audience where the people were primarily not at the front. These were people who were from more of a Haredi background and did not get involved in the army. Well, in last week's unit, we talked about Rabbi Yehuda Amital, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Etzion, right? Otherwise known as the Gush. It was the second of the Yeshivot Hezder, the Hezder Yeshivos, the first one being Karen B'Yavna. I'm an alum of Karen B'Yavna, right? And the goal of the Hezder Yeshivot was the understanding of the combination of service with Torah learning with service. The B'nai Torah across the board who serve in Hezder today, including many of my nephews. We have people in the shul who learned through Hezder. They did a machal program, but they were part of Hezder Yeshivos. They are the spirit and the lifeline of the yeshiva and of the army. In fact, in this book I just finished over Yontif, even in the secular books, they are pointing out that there were certain units that they never counted upon to be as successful as they were, but they all had the same thing in common. And what was that? The fact that they were all Hezdernikim, right? They were all Hezder boys. And when Hezder boys go up to the front, Hezder boys go up to the front with one mission in mind. And what's that? They are here to do God's work, right? And they are incredible. But at the same point in time, after the Yom Kippur War, we noted that Rav Amital personally and also nationally had a very big problem. He had lost Talmidim left and right. Remember, the casualty rate in the Yom Kippur War, easy number to remember, 2,222 individuals who fell in the war, and there were 7,000 plus who were injured at different levels of injury after the war. So you're talking about a very, very significant number of people in the Israeli population. Well, to lose Hezdernikim was a major toll on Rav Amital, and Rav Amital as a person was not only beaten up physically himself, in other words, he beat himself up physically over the loss of Hezdernikim, but over the loss of Jewish blood. You know, whether you're a Hezder, secular, religious, whatever the case was, it made him very, very uncomfortable. And we, after the war, you know, he turned around and he talked about the need for the religious Zionist community to re-examine itself, not to just point fingers as we started off this year tonight in explaining. Instead, he said that on the one hand, we have to understand that there was a geula, there was a redemption that came out of this war, and that victory was wonderful. But at the same point in time, we had to focus on the yisurim, the fact that there was a tremendous amount of pain. He offered the following comment, which we worked at. A Jew who believes that the events touching on the life of Am Yisrael are guided by a divine providence will naturally inquire as to their meaning and significance. The Torah and the Nevi'im command us to pay attention, but it's also natural intellectual inquiry for one based in faith. So if events pass one by without attempting to penetrate the depth of their meaning, the Chachamim considers such a person dead. Rav Amital, in rather his strong form, I had a chance to hear him a number of times in my lifetime. He was a very, very heartfelt individual, and he spoke from a heartfelt perspective. He himself, a Holocaust survivor, who went through a lot of personal metamorphoses, which we talked about last week, and he pushed himself into a certain direction. So on the one hand, he said, you have to go through Jewish life, and you have to ask questions. Why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to us? And if you don't, then you're not living life. You're dead, right? Not physically, but he said, you know, emotionally, you're not. If you don't ask why these things happen, there's something wrong with you. Yet at the same time, he understood, clearly we don't have the tools to know the secrets of Hashem and to know his considerations, motives, and intentions. like we say in the Navi, Kilomach Shabosai Mach Shabosechem Lo Darchechem Durachai, that my thoughts are not your thoughts. However, that doesn't exempt us from our obligation to observe and to delve. And he, as he told his Talmidim, this is also part of Torah, and we need to learn it. And so that was the second theme. An individual who represented a camp that did a lot more emotional introspection, which is no less Torah than Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz's thoughts, right? No less Torah, right? But at the same time, he injected a certain emotional component to us, which asked us to ask ourselves, why is what's happening happening? Why did we go through this? We can't just say all's well that ends well, because it didn't all end well. There were over 9,000, about close to 10,000 people and families whose lives were affected as a result of the Yom Kippur War from all different camps. And we have to ask ourselves, why did these things happen? And why? And what are we supposed to take away? The answers are a lot less forthcoming than the questions. And we'll see that in Mirtz Hashem next week also from an American perspective when we debate when we debate Rabbi Norman Lamb, and within it, a context of one great individual who is the anti-Rabbi Norman Lamb, somebody who has paralleled him very much lockstep in life. They're both philosophers, Jewish philosophers, both Talmidei Chachamim, both Rabbanim, both had different perspectives. We'll talk about Rabbi Norman Lamb, and we'll also in the process talk about a famous debate he had with Rabbi Dr. Shubi Spiro, Rabbi Schubert Spiro, who, by the way, did the opposite of Rabbi Lamb. Rabbi Lamb stayed in the United States. Rabbi Spiro made Aliyah with the Cleveland community that was around him. We'll talk about what the differences are and what the takeaway is for that next week. Tonight I want to do something different, and I specifically decided I wanted to do this tonight specifically because I want to talk about it's Hoshana Rabbah night, and it's important for us to get a different perspective. And I think I want to talk about an individual whose impact was it totally changed his life. He was heading in a certain trajectory in life. Anyway, he probably was, you know, going to wind up in some very lofty Jewish religious perspective, but this catapulted him into a totally different realm, and he lived that way all the way up until our time. I think he passed away in your lifetime, right? And you were already very much an active thinking person. I'm talking, of course, about Hagon Harav Ovadia Yosef. I'm in the middle of a recording. You're welcome to be in and hear. Yes, that part will be starting at 10:30. The Tillim, but you're welcome to stay for all the parts in advance. Okay, so who is Rav Ovadia Yosef, right? So as you know, Chacham Ovadia Yosef was a tremendous individual. He was, today we think about him, he was the Rishon Litzion, and he was the head of the Sephardic world. He was the head of the Sephardic world in there. If Rav Ovadia said it, the rest of the world bent. By the way, he was not just the head of the Sephardic world. His impact on the Ashkenazic world was tremendous as well. But prior to 1973, he was a relatively limited individual in terms of his scope and recognition, primarily in the Sephardic world. You're talking about an individual when he was born and in his early years in life, grew up in a poor but respectable home. He was discovered by, I think it was Rabbi Yehuda Tzedakah, the Rosh Yeshiva of Porat Yosef, who at one point in time tried to convince Rav Ovadia to stay in yeshiva and learn. He says, I can't. My father wants me to go work in the store. What am I supposed to do? So the next day, Rav Yehuda Tzedakah shows up in the store, puts on an apron, and Rav Ovadia's father looks at him and says to him, what's the Rosh Yeshiva doing here? Very respectful, Sfaradim, always respectful of Kavod HaTorah, one of the most beautiful things, and there are a lot of them. So he says, what's the Rosh Yeshiva doing here? And he gets all bent out of shape about the situation, and he says, what do you mean? Your son's Torah learning is so important to me that if someone has to work in the store, it better be me and not him. And this set a certain mindset in the mindset of the Rav Ovadia's father, and he sent him to go learn in yeshiva, and he learned. And boy, did he learn. And he had a zikaron and power of recall that was tremendous, but he also had a power of what we call zitzfleisch. What's that? They don't call it that in the Sephardic community. Zitzfleisch is stick-to-it power, sitting down, and he could learn for hours and hours and hours and amass this tremendous amount of material in his mind and put it together in certain ways. And there were things that were just unbelievable to see. There was a certain farm store in the Mea Shearim area where they had all sorts of additional works. And, you know, people would come in, and they would go in to look at the Sfarim and to You know, so you, they said that, you know, the Svarim store had bookshelves going all the way up to the top, and they were like rolling ladders that people had. So I remember one description of Rav Ovadia. He said, you walk into that Svarim store, perched on top of a ladder, one-handed, was Rav Ovadia Yosef, memorizing whatever Rishon or Achron he was looking for, and then he could cite it by memory for years and years later. This was Rav Ovadia Yosef. He married his Rabbanit Margalit, who was a very, very important personality in his life, even though she was not a public figure. She was very much not a public figure. True. And she specifically wanted a Talmid Chacham, and boy, did she find one, right? But she afforded every opportunity to make sure that nothing would sit on top of him so that he should be able to learn uninterrupted. At one point in time, he wound up in Cairo, right? And he spent some time as the chief rabbi of Cairo. It was a very difficult time in his life because what was going on in Cairo was an eye-opener for a guy who spent his whole life in yeshiva, right? There was corruption. There was kashrus in particular, just so you know, in the Jewish world at large. Right, when you're in the what we call the sticks, when you're in the suburbs and far out there, you will find that there are always great challenges for issues of kashrus. In the United States, for instance, if you study American Jewish history, you'll discover some of the greats of even the relatively modern era, the 18 and 1900s, you'll discover all sorts of funny business going on in kashrus, and whoever had the money, right, had the control. And so very often those were the butchers. Yeah, because they went after Rav Ovadia, and he didn't budge. There's a famous story that they tell about one point in time, someone came up to him and threatened to kill him and showed up with a gun. And what did he do? He turned around and he looked at the guy and he opened up his jacket and he said, just don't get it. Yeah, go ahead and shoot me over here. Don't get it on the jacket. Someone may need it one day, but just so you know, I'm not going to bend one iota. You can try. The guy ran off. He was so scared of Rav Ovadia in that point in time. But that, you know, that was Rav Ovadia in Cairo. Eventually got called back to Eretz Yisrael, I think by Rav Tzedakah and some of the other Rosh Yeshiva and Porat Yosef. And he wound up as chief rabbi in Tel Aviv for a number of years. And that brought us into the 70s. Okay, so it brings us into the 70s. I think it was 1972. I think that was the year that the chief rabbinate positions started to open. Every chief rabbi in Israel serves a term of 10 years. 10 years, very good, Gary, right? 10 years. And, of course, for the sake of parity, there is a Ashkenazic chief rabbi and a Rishon LeZion who is identified in English as the Sephardic chief rabbi. In 1972, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi was a very, very, very colorful character, a Talmid Chacham of world renown, but also an individual who is known for going it alone. His name? Rav Shlomo Goren. Anyone know who Rav Shlomo Goren was? Aside from the fact that he was chief rabbi of the State of Israel in the 70s and early 80s, right? He was also beforehand the chief rabbi of Tzahal, and he was known for many, many other things, but known in particular for doing something very, very extraordinary. He was the rabbi who came running in at the time of the 1967 war as the chief rabbi of Tzal. He was the one who came in with the soldiers, right, in 67 to take over the Kotel. He was celebrated all over. He was also, although it's lesser known, the man who conquered Hebron. We tell the story every year, but you know, he jumped in a jeep after they had liberated Yerushalayim. The next day he drove down to Hebron only with his assistant, the driver. They had one sidearm on themselves. Right, because chaplains are not allowed to carry weapons, so only the assistant had a revolver on his belt, and the assistant shot open the lock into Hebron, and they immediately they surrendered to Rav Goren. Not as well known story. So you're talking about an individual, but an individual who is a very unique in his style of psak halacha, very a little bit more out there, not necessarily in the mainstream of the halachic world. And there was a little bit of nerves among certain camps, among the Talmidei Chachamim, if you would just appoint a simple, not simple, but a more quiet Rishon LeZion, right, that there might be some challenge. What was the solution? Take the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, bring Rav Ovadia Yosef to sort of balance the power and sort of keep the chief rabbinate sort of some degree unified. So here's young Rav Ovadia Yosef. His counterpart in the Ashkenazic world is at this point in time a very, very well-recognized PR personality. Forget about the fact that he's also recognized in the Torah world. And here's Rav Ovadia Yosef, who is, formerly from Cairo, now of Tel Aviv, and he steps onto this big stage in 1972. What happens in 73? The war. Wow. And now all of a sudden, things change. You know, after the war, there was a memorial service, and Rav Ovadia Yosef offered the following words of consolation. They didn't stop him from bringing things up. And I'm going to read to you just in translation for the sake of the shir. He says, the Pasuk says in Shir Ashirim, Kol dodi dofek, that the voice of my beloved is knocking. Right? Piskli li, open up for me. Excuse me. Achosi, Yonasi, Tamasi, open up for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled. And the Jewish nation responds, Pashatati eskutanti echacha al bashena, rachatzti esraglai echacha antanfeim. I took off my coat. How am I going to put it on? I washed my feet. How am I going to soil them? And Rav Ovadia said, during the Six-Day War, we were shown miracles and wonders and signs of Geula from Shemayim, right? So much so that even the secular commanders of the IDF were running around, and even Yitzhak Rabin, who himself, unfortunately, has a famous past and future, starting in 73, that is, and even he said, Meis Hashem Haisa Zos, he neflas beineinu. Even Yitzchak Rabin, who didn't believe in Torah Mitzvah, said, this is Hashem's doing. It's 67, right? It's a marvelous thing. And what he means to, and Rav Ovadia says, that's what it means, kol dodi dofek piskili. Hashem is knocking, and he tells the Jewish people to open up. Open up, kechudo shalmachat. What does it mean, kechudo shalmachat? Like the eye of a needle. An observance of Torah mitzvos, and I'll open up for you kehechal shel ulam, like the opening size of a hall. So Rav Ovadia says the time for Rachmanas came, and if we would merit it, we would utilize this time to do tshuva before Hashem, to open an opening for Hashem in response to the love that Hashem showed us in 67. However, said Rav Ovadia, we messed up. We acted lazily and carelessly, because we said to ourselves in 67, Pashatati eskutanti, I took off my coat. How am I going to put it on? Rachatzti esraglai chachan, it's raining outside. How am I going to go to shul? How am I going to go ahead? It's too hard for me. How am I going to put on tefillin every day? Right? And when Hashem sees that we're not even opening up the opening size of a needle, so then he doesn't open for us either. And it's similar to what tzaddikim say, that if we see that Hashem is not opening up the size of a kepisko sheulam, the size of an opening hall, it must be an indication that we didn't open up the size of the needle. Then he continued with this hesped. It's an unbelievable hesped, right? And he said, Dodi shalach yadom en achor. The pasuk in Shir Hashirim says that my beloved put his hands in the hole of the door. Umei hamu alav. I my insides were calling for him, right? That's what it says, right? I wanted. Hashem continued to show us with goodness to do tshuva, right? And what was the goodness that Hashem showed us? So let's look at history. I've been quoting the secular history for you. Let me add a little bit more color through the eyes of Rav Ovadia. Rav Ovadia says, look, the United Nations tried to force Am Yisrael to go back to the 67 borders. That was called the pre-67 borders, the green line. You'll hear a lot in the news about the green line. Well, the green line means that we give up Yerushalayim, that we give up all those things that we gained, Hebron, and all the other areas that we gained in 67, right? The Golan Heights and all that other stuff. He says that, so the United Nations tried, they weren't successful. By the way, nevertheless, there were some secular Jews who desecrated Shabbos by driving to Ramallah, to Jenin, to Shechem, and Gaza. And this is ungratefulness of the highest order, says Rav Ovadia. And such brazen ungratefulness that the Pasuk says, Kamti ani liftoach, when we finally say when I finally got up to open the door to seek Hashem, v'dodi chamakavar, that my beloved turned away, and then we'll daven and it will be too late, because I looked at him, bikashtiv v'lo mitzasiv, I look for him and I can't find him, kirativ v'lo anani, I call out to him and he doesn't answer me. It's if Hashem doesn't listen to our tfilos. And of course, what happened at that point in time, when people were driving to Jenin and Gaza, before the 73 war broke out, there was a long period called a war of attrition. What was the war of attrition, everybody? It wasn't really a war. You look in the Israel history, they don't talk about the war of attrition. It was the non-war war, right? What's the non-war war? The skirmishes. They're flare-ups. There are battles that were taking place. And it took lives of some of our soldiers. Hashem yimkom damam. May Hashem take over their blood. And that's what led to the Yom Kippur War. And that's what we say, Mitzauni Hashomrim Hasovivim Ba'ir Hikuni Pitzauni. That the Shirashim continues. The watchmen go around the city. They found me. They hit me. They wounded me. Right? And Nasnu Rididi Me'alai Shomrei Achamot. That what? The keepers of the walls took my mantle away from me. We suffered. There's so many fallen and wounded casualties. By the way, that was the description of the Yom Kippur War in the eyes of the Aragot Commission. That during the war, while the war was going on, right, what happened? All the great things, like we said before, all the things we were so proud of as a nation, right? They were all the things that were actually the things that were looked down upon. So many widows and orphans, says Rav Ovadia, cry all day as a result of their losses. How harsh are these decrees? It seems that if Hashem doesn't want to have mercy on us, as the Pasuk says, Shoko Amudei Shayesh Mula Imba Sapirim, his body is polished ivory overlaid with sapphires, meaning it's as if Hashem has become as rigid as ivory as a result of his din. Nevertheless, Rav Ovadia says, we have to understand that his mouth, the Pasuk says, is very sweet. And he's altogether chiko mamtakim v'kulom achmadim. We say that his mouth is sweet, he's altogether lovely. And Hashem only means to lead us to do tshuva before him. And that's what we say, kasher yiyaser ish esbeno Hashem elokecha miyasreka. So Rav Ovadia's perspective from a hesped perspective is to look at everything to look at the events of the day in a very Torah-based way with mercy. And then he adds, because Rav Ovadia, again, he's the chief rabbi, and he's speaking, he's speaking to the people, and he has to speak and offer consolation, not just Musar. But Rav Ovadia never felt that the two things couldn't mix together. Sometimes we have to give a lesson, and at the same time, also offer consolation. So he mentions that in the future, the Medrash says, Hashem will send the Nevi'im to console the Jewish nation. And when the Nevi'im go out to the Jewish nation will say, we got the punishments from the hand of Hashem. When it comes time for Nechama, we want Hashem to send the Nechama himself. And the Nevi'im will say, listen, Ribono Shel Olam, the Jewish nation doesn't want consolation from us. You have to bring the consolation, and Hashem will do it. And that's what we say, Kasher Yaseh, like Hashem will be the one who will come along, and he will provide the nechama. So this is the backdrop when Rav Ovadia Yosef approaches the Yom Kippur War from a Agadah perspective, from a more of a historical perspective, from a lessons learned perspective. This is. The way he summed up the Yom Kippur War for the people, there is something here. There is something that we have to think about. There are things that we can improve. There are things that we have to realize. But at the same time, we can't give up the hope. We shouldn't give up the hope. And if I stopped right here, you'd walk away saying, wow, that was tremendous. And I will tell you that I would not have covered 5% of what Rav Ovadia Yosef meant for the Yom Kippur War and what the Yom Kippur War did for Rav Ovadia Yosef, because there's 95% that I would have left out in total. Exactly right. I will tell you that fundamentally, the change of Rav Ovadia Yosef from a local Talmud Chacham and a local Gadol B'Yisrael who had risen to the position of chief rabbi to the person who ultimately, and for the next 40-plus years, would become the leader of Sephardic Jewry and the major player on the stage of world Jewry from the Sephardic perspective and beyond, right, came about 1973 and 74. And why was that? Because the bottom line is, as you pointed out, when you go out to war, and for those of you who study the Daf Yomi, right, and finish Masechta Gittin, so you will remember very clearly that there is one of the major problems that happens when Jewish people go out to war, Jewish men go out to war, is that if they don't come back, then their wives wind up as agunos. The term aguna today refers to a woman who's chained. And so very often when you will hear the term aguna today, if you're reading in modern time, you'll read about people who are hoping to find a divorce document, right? And they're having a hard time getting the divorce document. But that's not really what happened in the classic sense of aguna. The Gemara at the end of Yevamos, in detail, and spottedly in a bunch of other places, describes a different type of aguna, a woman whose husband disappeared. Remember, Jewish people were traveling all around the world. They didn't have good communications. Sometimes all sorts of crazy things happened to them, and we weren't able to identify who they were, where they were, and what we would do about them. Well, now enter a situation like a war. In fact, David HaMelech was so concerned about agunos, what did he do? Anyone? Every soldier, before they went out to war, did what? They wrote a get for their wives. So if they didn't come back, their wives would not remain agunos, right? They wrote a get in such a way that this is the way it should be. Well, you had a big war. You had 2,222 people who we knew were dead. But you had other people who were gone. There were people who were, you know, I didn't get a chance to tell the story everywhere, but I think I mentioned it, ironically, in the Sephardic Minyan, right? We had, among the first group that got captured was a certain individual named Hillel Unsdorfer. Hillel Unsdorfer was down in one of the areas right on the Egyptian border, right? There was a whole, at that point in time, the army had made a decision to put up a bunch of these small little huts, so to speak, and they kept, to keep watch to see where the Egyptians going to cross the Suez Canal. Well, unbeknownst to, it was Yom Kippur, they kept a very light skeletal crew there. Hillel Unsdorfer came down he was a religious fellow, came with a Sefer Torah, so that those people should dam Yom Kippur with a minion. He was a chazan, not a soldier. I mean, he was a soldier, but he was on Miluim, and this is his service, right? He was one of the first faces of the war, because when the Egyptians took him captive, right, he came out, he waved a surrender flag. What do you use for the flag? A talis. And he took the Sefer Torah out, so it shouldn't be destroyed by the Egyptians. And he was put in a POW camp with a whole bunch of other soldiers, right? What do you do with those people? You don't know what's going to happen to them. What do you do with all the soldiers who got gunned down in the middle of the desert? And you couldn't get their bodies in and out. The stories are horrific. And you read them, and even in the secular books, you have a lot of aguna issues. Not every rabbi answers aguna shailos. I'd like to add to you, and Dr. Wenger just walked in, so he'll tell you also, because we spent some time on this when we had our Ukraine series, right? We talked about the Shach, right? Not every posek answers aguna shailos. We have rules, all right? And it's not enough for one posek to take it on, right? It requires... when we're not sure whose body is whose, right, we need to prove somebody's dead. And until we do that, we have to be very careful. Remember, we discussed some of this in other shiurim. But, here we had a bunch of people and brand new shilas, right, that came up. So in a presentation he gave, I think in 75, and it can be found in a work called Masa Uvadja, or if you look at the sixth volume of Yabia Omer and a bunch of tshuvas, right, you'll see all sorts of exciting examples where Rav Ovadia had to take all sorts of new ideas and apply Torah values to them and Torah concepts to them, right, in order to be able to create heterim that would then have to be corroborated and okayed by other rabbanim to save all these women. Well, Rav Ovadia took on himself that he was not going to move on until every single aguna from the Yom Kippur War would be able to go ahead and have her case be resolved and either marry or prove that her husband was still alive, etc. That is something that shows a tremendous love for Am Yisrael. And he writes in other tshuvas, in that sixth volume of Yabia Omer, that he writes, he says, I'm sorry, I can't deal with your Shaila right now. I am involved in work that I can't deal with. The history works as follows. How did he wind up getting involved? So after Rav Gorin had gone on to become the Ashkenazic chief rabbi, the Rav HaRashi for Tzahal was Rav Mordechai Piron. And he went to Rav Ovadia together Rav Gad Navon, and he asked, who was the assistant chief rabbi, and he asked Rav Ovadia, can we form a Beis Din to solve a couple of Aguna cases? How many were a couple? 1,000. When you look at the amount of research that has to go into being matir 1,000 cases, now you understand the problem. He quotes, he notes the difficulty. He quotes the comments of the Bach in the Sefer Bach HaChadashos that being matir and aguna is like rebuilding one of the Churvos Yerushalayim. And he quotes a whole bunch of other reasons why he was going to be involved in this endeavor. And each case that he got involved with, he looked at individually. Now, in some cases, it was really just a question of just finding the right witnesses, right? Which is an undertaking. It's a major organizational process. But the easiest way to be matir and aguna is to find two witnesses who'll be able to turn around and say, we saw him, he's dead. We can say for sure it was him. We knew for sure it was him, and he died, right? That's like the ultimate. You have that, you know the person's dead. You know what else you can do? If you can find two witnesses who can identify a body to say for sure that's the body, right, that also works. However, there's a limitation. What's the limitation? 3 days. Doc, what happens to a body after 3 days? There is enough decomposition, according to the Gemara, the body goes down. It's not recognizable anymore. And so therefore, we see that Rav Ovadia was desperate to be halachically true on the one hand, but also to be compassionate at the same time. So what I want to do for the rest of this year, which will, is to give you 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different examples, right, of situations where you couldn't use this system and you needed somebody with the plates, with the shoulders of a Rav Ovadia to lead this process. And maybe we'll talk it out for a second. So there was one instance where Rav Ovadia Yosef discovered that there was no evidence at all that was usable, right? However, the one thing that they did do is around the soldier whose head was mangled to the point that they couldn't recognize who his face was, they figured out that while they couldn't use his face, which is what you need to recognize, right, they had one thing, his dog tags. Did you think about it? Was that what you asked your dad before? Right? Can you use a guy's dog tags? Right? Good. You know, that's a good question. Most of the time, what are dog tags? Anyone? Every soldier has a unique set of dog tags, right? And And they're there for one purpose. What's the purpose? Figure out who's who. But it's like a necklace. So technically speaking, what's the problem with using dog tags? Right. In fact, there at the same time in the 70s, there was a famous different army television program known as MASH, right? Which starred Alan Alda. And certainly in one of the episodes, this one guy comes in and he pretends that he's Jewish because he took the dog tags of somebody else in the Korean War, right? And while he was going ahead and doing that, he had a problem in the process. And so, he got caught. So is that true, halach lamaisa? Is that true, from a halachic perspective? And so the Gemara in Yevamos brings down that technically speaking, you have to be able to identify somebody using his face. And when it comes to clothing, we have to be concerned, like Alan Alda was in MASH, that maybe people change clothing, right? And that's brought down the halacha. Now what do you do with this guy? Well, we have a dog tags. Anyone? What do you do? We got to solve this problem. We got to solve this guy's life. His wife is dying to know. Pardon the very bad pun. What? See, we can't use DNA. It's 1973. By the way, you raised a different question that Rav Ovadia would get involved in, you know, for many years thereafter, right? But, you know, what do you do about the situation? Birthmarks. Huh? Birthmarks. But birthmarks can be, are not unique. Yeah? Fingerprints. Huh? Fingerprints. Right, so they didn't have the technology solid enough to be able to rely on fingerprints yet, right? So Rav Ovadia says, one second. There are certain things that we know that people don't lend ever. Ever. Right? There are certain things people don't lend. And the Gemara says that a person doesn't lend his ring, his wallet, right, etc. And so therefore, Rav Ovadia says, you know what? Based on that, what else do people don't lend out? What? Dog tags. Obviously, he didn't see MASH, right? But that's the way it should be. And so he argued that the same thing is true about the dog tags. But this is not brought down in the Beis Yosef's Tshuvos. It's not mentioned in Shulchan Aruch. And Rav Ovadia has one major limitation. He will never, ever innovate against Maran Beit Yosef. He will never innovate against the Shulchan Aruch. And so he said, you can't use a wallet and a ring to get out and to get a woman out of an aguna situation. Then he said, well, wait a second. There is a comment of Tosas and others who argue that a ring and a wallet are not normally lent out, but in rare exceptions, they might be. And that's the reason why we don't allow somebody to use a wallet or a ring, because sometimes on a crazy situation, that the risk is too big. However, Rav Ovadia argued, that's true for a ring, which may have some value, or a wallet, which may have some value. But as far as dog tags are concerned, where the whole point of the dog tag is to identify the person wearing it, there's no reason why someone would exchange it, unless, of course, right, it's going to get you out of the army. That's what happened in that episode of MASH, right? It was going to be for another person who was going to try to go ahead and it was going to be for somebody who was going to try to go ahead and get out of the situation and get out of the army. But here, the switching of identities, what happens to you in the Israeli army if you switch identities? Anyone? So he said the government would provide you with a much more severe punishment, more so than whatever you thought you would get by switching dog tags and pretending you're dead. And he added that the lack of a heter by a wallet and a ring was only when, in peacetime, when people were traveling around the world, right? But this is a war, and there's a greater expectation of death, which means that a person is less likely to lend out his dog tags. Ergo, Rav Ovadia argued that although normally we would not use outside simanim, for this situation, given these heterim, you can use a dog tag. Unbelievable. Who would have thought that way? Who would have had the combination of both the guts and also the knowledge to be able to work the situation out? Then he had another shaila that came up, and it involved an ID card on a person's body, right? Now, it wasn't a dog tag. Dog tags don't get taken off, but there was an ID card. Is that good enough? So here, the problem of the fact that it may be easily moved from a body, right, and transferred, right? I left it in the wrong pair of pants. You took my pants, right? We're in a foxhole. When the guns go off, the grenades start landing, everybody takes whatever pants they can. Remember, you're talking about most, you know, good chunks of this war was fought in unbelievable heat, right? And crazy stuff was going on. Well, the Chasam Sofer says, if you have an ID card that's stored in a secret compartment of your pants, right? Not really an issue, because who takes out an ID card from your secret compartment or your pants? And so the ID card or the broken dog tag was in the regular pocket. So in a lot of these cases, and so he said, I can't use that as a heter. But he quoted the Sefer Yoshua, not the work of Nach, but rather the commentary that appears at the end of the Sefer Avnei Miluim, who brings down that if you find a passport in a dead man's clothing, you can assume that since at any moment in time you can be told, present it, you are very careful to lend it out before you lend it out. And the same thing is true for a military ID card. Now, Rav Ovadia is not so comfortable with this heter, less so than with the dog tags. But he says, where people don't, we do have to recognize that people did not lend out their army uniforms, right? And so therefore, we're talking the far-fetched case of lending into account to deal with a sveik-sveika, to create a heter. And under these circumstances, he presented this to the rest of the Beis Din, and everyone said, where it was necessary, he used it. And that was that. Then he pointed out, what about dental records and fingerprints, which was your question, right? And so he said, this established these. He said 100%, whereas beforehand, people were not so comfortable. They didn't know the science behind it, right? You know what he said? This war turned around and gave us the heter. By the way, this would be a preview of a certain situation where Rav Ovadia would be called upon again to issue some of the big, big decisions of the day. Where? When would this come up again in his life where this aspect of Rav Ovadia would be very critical? Heter agunos. 9/11. Anyone who wrote a tshuva in support of a heteragunos in 2001, you will find, when you analyze, the individual who was called upon to write a sign-off was the great Rav Ovadia Yosef, at this point already the Posek Hador, right? Already recognized as the Posek Hador. There was two other cases, and we'll close on them. There was a picture, a photo, that was taken within 3 days. So we mentioned to you before that you can't see somebody. If a person comes along and he says, "I saw the person dead. He had been dead for 3 days." Can you use that as testimony? No, you cannot, because that face is decomposed. However, at this point, the people are testifying days after, but the picture was taken when? Within the 3 days, right? So is a photo like a is it like a simon, or is it a testimony? What's the difference, right? If a photo is a simon, then you're looking at a photo to identify a person. Then after 3 days, it doesn't work. But if it's like actual testimony, right? The photo is the testimony, and you're just testifying that the testimony is legitimate, right? You'd be able to make somebody a heter. Rav Ovadia Paskin, that we assume pictures are treated like simanim, and technically speaking, we shouldn't be allowed to use it alone. And that should really be a problem. But simanim, what's the concern after 3 days? Let's go over it again. What was the concern after 3 days? Huh? Decomposition. Well, in 1973, as opposed to 2023, which I'll explain why in a second. In 1973, people were not as sophisticated, right, as they are today. Today, if I give your son a picture and I asked him to alter it so that it looks like I can be sitting at a table with Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Aaron Cutler, and Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, right, your son, with about 3 minutes of ingenuity and a computer, could probably make it look real legitimate. I have my brother-in-law's father, Milton Pfeiffer, who's a wonderful, wonderful man. There's a lot of wonderful stuckas. So a number of years ago, he ran a stucka campaign where, if you sent him a photo, he could send you a picture back for your sukkah, and it looked like you were sitting in the sukkah with all these great rabbanim through all the different ages. And it was like a great shtick. So I remember when he showed it to me, he has a very distinct face, Mr. Pfeiffer, and he doesn't have a beard. So, but in this picture, he's wearing a shtreimel, and he's got payas, and no beard, and he's in the picture with everybody else. In 1973, Milton Pfeiffer wasn't able to do that, and Rafi would not have been able to do that, partially because Rafi was not walking on earth yet, right? But the fact is, most people, photos, Rav Ovadia said, they were not forgeable, right? And he says it's similar to what Rabban Gamliel used to do with the moon. You remember the situation? Rabban Gamliel had images of the moon on his, the Gemara describes, on the top of his office to be able to test the witnesses for Rosh Chodesh. And so here also, he said, the woman's husband went to war and didn't come home. Her aguna status is dirabanan post-war. Let's use the photo as a simon emtsai. Again, the hardliners, no, people would be scared to try such a heter, right? But because Rav Ovadia had realized that this is what you got to do. You can't just look at the klal, right? You have to think of the women. You can't just look at the women. Compassion is very important. But compassion has to fit within the boundaries of Torah. This is Rav Ovadia's, I think this is true of all poskim, but Rav Ovadia really highlighted this in a major way in 1973 during the Yom Kippur War and immediately thereafter for the next 2 years. The last example I want to give to you is a little bit, is probably the wildest example, right? And even Rav Ovadia says that it's the wildest example. I told you before, the crown jewel of the IDF in 67 was? The Air Force, right? In 1973, the Air Force took it on the chin, right? Until they got up and running, it was already a week into the war, right? And they were losing left and right. Tell me I'm wrong, Doc? You'll be wrong, because I've read the Aragot Commission's report. In fact, Benny Pellid, who was the head of the Air Force, barely escaped scrutiny, and that's partially because the Air Force was such a well-oiled machine that nobody wanted to turn anybody else in, as opposed to the rest of the Army, where all the generals turned to everybody and each one turned against the other one. And it's pretty wild. Another discussion for another point in time, not during a shir, but happy to discuss. Well, when soldiers get stuck in bad situations, right? There was one episode that I read about over Yantiv. Again, I'm going back 50 years. One pilot ejected on a return flight back from Syria, right? This is not the shuttle we're talking about. So he ejected, and the people, thank God, they had tried a particular maneuver, which was very, very poor taste, and they ran into a whole bunch of surface-to-air missiles, which were brand new then, and the Russians were supplying the Syrians. And basically, the Air Force just walked into a trap, and they had zero success in this particular mission, right? And as they're turning back, they lost one of the planes, but the soldier had evacuated. He had ejected in time. They were so excited because it looked like the parachute's going to land. He lands. He lands on the right side of the border, and he tells the people, it looks like I'm going to land on the right side of the border, in other words, in Israel, and I'm going to land in the middle of this kibbutz. And the people in the war room are breathing comfortably for a minute, and then all of a sudden he says, whoops, we've got a big problem. We're surrounded by Syrian tanks. Right? We're surrounded by Syrian tanks. This was a situation the first couple of days of the war. Till Sukkot, it did not look very, very good till the middle of Sukkot. I'm telling you, the history is incredible. And the Shaila that I want to mention to you is the last one. It was not as lucky as even that guy, who, by the way, died in Israel. Right? He got shot there by the Syrians, and he died there. And at least his body was found. Right? Here we have a situation where a pilot ejected. Right? They're traveling in a squadron. You understand, right? They have, you know, a formation. Right? So he gets hit. He sees the plane, the soldier next to him, the pilot next to him, sees the plane explode, and he sees that the guy whose plane exploded did not eject, and he heard the impact over the radio. Now, what do we have? What do we have? What about this guy's wife? We have eyewitness that the plane was destroyed. We don't know one thing for sure. We don't have a visual of the body. So did the guy get out? Did the guy not get out? This is a nightmare. This is one of the worst nightmares you can have. Can we use this soldier's testimony? He didn't see a dead body. He didn't see a live body. He didn't see anything. Right? What does he do? Can we use this for an aguna? So Rav Ovadia comes along, and this is one of the toughest cases by his own admission to identify. He says, even if the pilot ejected, right? If he ejected based on the flight of the flight path that they were in the formation, he would have landed in the middle of the sea. And that's what we call Mayim She'in Lahem Sof, into waters that have no end, right? And waters that have no end, what would it have meant? The assumption is he's dead. So he says, we have two robes that he's dead. Most people don't survive impact. And the pilot should have seen that he ejected, and even if he did, most people don't survive in Mayim She'in Lahem Sof. So you have two, that's what we call a svek, sveka, a double suffix. With two suffix, we say svek, sveka, velo yamus, that it's a suffix, suffix, right? And he would be considered dead. And of course, Rav Ovadia adds that unlike in the olden days, and we'll close on this point, he says, today we would have gotten word to the family, right? In the Yom Kippur War, even those people who are taken captive managed to get a word out to their family. And so based on all this, Rav Ovadia turns around and he says, I think we can make a heter under those circumstances, right? And so this is the basis that Rav Ovadia puts into play. And so, like I said, these are the terms that Rav Ovadia put in order to create a heter for agunos. What do we take away from Rav Ovadia and the Yom Kippur War? Torah leadership, Torah lessons, that is, after all, the theme. So as I told you before, Rav Ovadia moved up a tremendous line as a result of the Yom Kippur War. He traveled and catapulted into a new level, but he taught us two things at the same point in time. And what's that? A Jew can always, on the one hand, have a tremendous, tremendous impact and show compassion for fellow Jews. And that this needs to be something that's primary in our lives, even though it's hard. At the same time, while having that compassion, a Jew should understand that the Torah is a compassionate Torah. The way of the Torah, its ways are the ways of pleasantness, and its means are the means of shalom. And if that meant for 2 years, Rav Ovadia couldn't do anything else but solve Aguna crises, he was going to do it until every single Aguna was solved. By the way, that inspired others to make sure also, after the 2001 experience at 9/11, Rav Ovadia led, and there were others as well. The Beis Din of America played a massive role here. Rav Mordechai Willig, Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, right? And making sure that every single Aguna who would have come out of that situation was also able to go ahead and remarry. So again, while we have already looked at Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, and we've already looked at Rav Yehuda Amital, we are also adding in Rav Ovadia Yosef, from a halachic perspective. When there's a halachic issue, Jews have to work together to make sure that they can solve it. And the only way to solve it is by reaching out to our gedolim, who never shy away from difficult situations. And Be'ezus Hashem, next week we'll talk about the American perspective, because we have to figure out what are we supposed to be taking away from the Yom Kippur War. And to do that, I think we'll turn to those who weren't there. They were here with you and me. We'll talk about Rabbi Lam, we'll talk about Rabbi Shubi Spiro, and Be'ezus Hashem, we'll take this all up next week when we meet again Thursday night on the Zoom. Thank you all very much.